Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
There's a widely held view in football management that you should never go back. If you've achieved success at a club in the past, there's nothing to be gained by taking the same job again in the hope of reliving old glories. But what if your first spell wasn't a success at all? What if you didn't even make it through a full season in charge of one of the biggest clubs in the world? In that case, what have you got to lose by giving it another rattle? That's just got to be the mindset of David Moyes when Manchester United inevitably come calling during the international break, asking him, begging him, to replace Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Welcome to Monday Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi, Ken.
He's the biggest fool in Manchester.
Hey there, Owen. How's it going?
It's getting closer, isn't it? The return.
What a story. What a story it would be.
I know there is apparently a lack of football knowledge at Old Trafford and all that kind of stuff among the hierarchy, but surely they've at least seen the highlights of West Ham ending Liverpool's unbeaten run. The same Liverpool team that humiliated United 2 weeks ago. They might even have seen David Moyes in his post-match interview fielding an actual question about whether or not West Ham are title contenders this season. And then, you know, from there it's just a quick look at David Moyes' Wikipedia page, tells them that he has previously held the position of Man United manager, so he knows the club, he knows where the bodies are buried, even as own body.
You got the job on a technicality of a legend who's recommended
job. He's just the dream candidate. Also, he's gone back to West Ham and it's been a success there. So the only question that remains, Ken, is can he be persuaded to abandon West Ham's title charge?
I dare say he probably could.
Well, it is a step down. It would be an act of charity, really.
Unfinished business. Unfinished business is a powerful motivating force, you know. And especially if he could bring Ricey with him in his back pocket. In his enormous back pocket, that, you know, it could be a player manager combination that could make a big impact. I was going to say, oh no, Moyes knows he's better off out of there. But when I thought about it for a couple more seconds, I realized, no, of course he probably would take that job.
Oh yeah,
I mean, you know, it's
you'd have to if you're David Moyes and you're given a chance to go back to Man United to do it all over.
Just the fact that they'd come crawling back to you would be 75% of the way to full redemption. And then if you actually did manage to be one of their best manager since Ferguson, which is not that high a bar, then you know it would be statue time. David Moyes would be in the statue zone, but you know, I don't want to talk about David Moyes in terms of a possible future return to Manchester United when in fact there's still all of this. We have to wallow like pigs in the mud of the glory of this West Ham
We do.
Victory.
We do. I'm going to hold you there. Get into that in 1 second, just to let you know. Miguel Delaney and Jacob Steinberg are on the show today. It's our last Premier League show for a little bit because of international football. A certain big game coming up at Lands End Road on Thursday night. World Service members will be treated to build up to the Republic of Ireland against Portugal during the week, and our post-match analysis show on Friday. You can join up now on secondcaptains.com for £5 a month plus VAT. But Ken, please report on Moyes.
How many times have you asked me to do that now? I have to say, Owen, I didn't think this was going to happen. I didn't think David Moyes was going to reemerge as a serious force in top level football management. You know, I have to say that I thought Sociedad, you know, Sunderland, I thought these experiences had broken the man. Mm-hmm. And I was wrong.
Well, even Ken, I have to say, even I wouldn't have foreseen that they would be in the top three in the Premier League at this point of this season. I thought he could steady the ship.
Big of you to admit that on.
Steer them clear of relegation and maybe have them going for top 10. But to have them firmly ensconced in the Champions League places is pretty good going, all right.
Yeah, you know, I think what West Ham have going for them, and I think it was decisive in the game yesterday, is that kind of old-fashioned Moyes quality of strength. I don't mean that to sound like patronizing, oh, West Ham are a strong team, but like it is so important. And this was the thing that his Everton team had, but the Everton team was physically strong, but also a bit slow. Whereas this West Ham team, like Liverpool couldn't contain them at all. And okay, I think Liverpool were hard done by, Owen. I do think it's a bit of a hard luck story when Jurgen Klopp afterwards was talking about the decisions. And I think in the first few minutes of the game, there was two massive decisions that went against Liverpool. One of them was the West Ham goal, which I thought was a clear foul.
Oh, give it over, goalkeeper, protect the species.
Ken, what are you talking about, Ken?
Well, it's a clear foul. I mean, it was one of these...
Who did the fouling? But,
by who? Because I couldn't work out. On match of day, they were saying it was Antonio. Antonio was blocking. And then other people were saying Agbon.
Antonio was there. I mean, Antonio was doing what I think you really should be doing, like in terms of just getting into the goalkeeper's space. But it was like Ogbonna who committed the foul in terms of he jumped into Alisson.
With what part of his body did he foul?
With the arm that stopped Alisson's arm from punching the ball.
Alisson managed to flick it in with his own.
Alisson is trying. How many times do you see goalkeepers try to punch the ball with the near hand to the ball that's coming to them, which also happens to be their weak hand? Alisson, as nobody seems to notice. I mean, I was listening, pundit after pundit, watching this and going, "Nah, let it flow." You know, pundit after pundit, and I'm like, he's trying to punch the ball with his right hand. He's a right-handed goalkeeper. The ball is coming, is an in-swinging ball, which is coming towards him, and he's going to punch the ball with his right hand away, and that's the hand that Ogbonna's arm blocks. It stops. Ogbonna gets nowhere near the ball. He stops Alisson. He physically obstructs Alisson from getting the ball.
He physically jumps for the ball, and it's only a foul in the sense that you do sometimes often see those fouls given against goalkeepers, and it's always wrong. Goalkeepers are given extra protection for absolutely no reason.
Klopp pointed out that they're given extra protection precisely because of the reason that their arms are part of the game. You know, he can play the ball with his arm. A goalkeeper's arm is like a player's leg. You know, so if you see contact on a player's leg in the penalty area, you know, that more often than not, the rules have been twiddled around it, obviously, more often than not, that's a penalty. Whereas if a player's are arm to arm in the penalty area, that doesn't matter.
Well, if Ogbonna physically turns around, takes both his hands, grabs, pins Alisson's arms against his body, then yeah, mate, that's a foul.
You don't have to wrap the goalkeeper in a straitjacket. You know, you don't have to break someone's leg for it to be a foul. Although Craig Pawson seems to think that you do, because that's getting onto the other one. Craig Pawson, remember, is the same referee that didn't think it was a foul on Harvey Elliott until he saw the broken leg dangling, at which point he whipped out a red card. The same referee sees a foul by Cresswell over the ball into Henderson, and over the ball scissors tackle. Pogba was sent off for one which was similar, I think, in the Manchester United Liverpool game, where he makes initial contact with the ball but then comes over it. Same thing with Cresswell, but it's not even a foul. I thought that was remarkable. But
I'm can I say I'm with you on that one? I'd like to continue the argumentative tone because I'm quite enjoying it so far. But I'm with you. I mean that Cresswell one, there were almost two separate red card tackles, one with his left foot and one with his right foot in the same motion.
Remarkable.
How it wasn't given as a free.
How is it not given? And I mean, I think you're getting this sort of bystander effect with like between the referee and VAR, where the ref is going, ooh, VAR will have a look at that, and then VAR saying, well, you know, the ref didn't do anything. We don't want to undermine him. And everyone's just sort of like, well, I suppose we'll just pretend that didn't happen then. It's just like, this is incredible. Like, I mean, it's obvious. And obviously, if those decisions happen, if those decisions go the other way, then you probably get a very different game. But having said that, I don't feel as though West Ham were... I still think West Ham deserved to win the game and were the better team in the game. You know, like... having got this, I mean, again, I just want to say the Ogbonna one is a really clear foul. Like, I can't believe that people don't see that.
We have your views on the record there. Continue.
Yeah, it's a really clear foul. Watch again. But anyway, at that point, West Ham, I felt maybe a bit early, decided, okay, well, we're winning now. Now it's time to protect our lead. And I thought, did David Moyes, like, really, was he really impressed by Gareth Southgate's England in the Euros final, but was called away before the end of the game or something? Like, he was like, you know,
they seem to have this one under control.
85 minutes is too long to kind of, you know, to defend
to declare
a lead. It's just too, it's like, great, we've got an early goal, but we kind of can't act as though there's only 5 minutes still to play here. And you know, Liverpool unsurprisingly managed to get back into it. But then the second half, basically West Ham then changed and played, I think, the way that they should have been playing throughout the first half, which is to say they were running forward with a bit more abandon. And, you know, you saw the second goal they scored, the 4-0 goal. I mean, Alisson had a bad game, you know, I mean, on all of the goals. Even the one that he was, well, the one that he was fouled, I thought he was unfairly blamed for. But the other two were terrible goals for him to concede. But, you know, it looks so bad, but it's because his starting position is so high that when Fornals, you know, he's kind of backing off a bit as Fornals is coming through, but he's still way off his line. You know what I mean? It's a shot which, if he's closer to his goal, he actually will save that shot easily. But like he plays high because he's trying to control the space behind the defence, which he doesn't expect is going to be closed down so quickly. All these West Ham players rampaging through, and Joel Matip, as far as I can see, just not seeing Fornals. You know, he steps forward as though he's trying to play Mikel Antonio offside, but the ball goes to the player on the far side, Fornals, who Matip, it's like, if you look at it, I don't think he actually even sees him. It's like Fornals is slightly running on the blind side of him. That it just shows how many players West Ham had bursting through the centre. And then obviously another set piece where, you know, Alisson is poor on it. But the Liverpool defence in general is poor. I mean, look at Trent Alexander-Arnold. Just
any foul, on Alisson for that one, Ken?
I don't think that was a foul.
I really looked.
I don't think that was a foul. I mean, it's simple. The first one was a foul. The second one wasn't a foul. I mean, it's simple, like, sure. You know. But anyway, West Ham won the game, and Liverpool a lot of draws and now defeat. So they're in this strange position where I think that the four wins out of four in the Champions League have kind of put a gloss on things to the extent that their league campaign, they're now averaging, you know, 2 points a game, which would have been considered a great standard for them to be hitting 20 years ago. But now, if you hit 2 points a game, you know, you're hoping to get the fourth Champions League spot. You know what I mean? Yeah. Okay, you know, last season the points totals were a bit lower, but... yeah, you'll usually get the fourth Champions League spot, but you're not going to be winning the league.
Well, except City beating last week, Chelsea dropping points at the weekend against Burnley. It feels like, now, we all know any of these teams, and, you know, City in particular, you could easily just head off in a 12-game winning run. But at the moment, that's not happening for any of the top teams.
I do feel that particularly about City. I do feel that about City. Why do I feel that as well?
Because we've been bigging up Chelsea the whole time, but I was talking to somebody about it yesterday, and it's like, we're both saying, yeah, City will be the team to do that. I don't know why it wouldn't be Chelsea, though, or Liverpool. For that matter,
because you've seen City do it so many times, and you know that City have got like a system that basically works, and then they can win, you know, 90% of the games in the league, and sometimes they're gonna have, you know, sometimes they're gonna not score, or, you know, these things will happen. But you've just seen them once they get rolling, and maybe there's some signs this week that they're going to. I mean, I don't necessarily want. Well, actually, yeah, I mean, the stories of the weekend. You know, there's two managers are sacked. Farke at Norwich was sacked. Dean Smith was sacked. I mean, I feel sorry for Dean Smith because I mean, okay, he lost five in a row. The last game that they didn't lose was the 1-0 win at Old Trafford. That was the 25th of September. Since then, lost to Tottenham 2-1. Lost at home to Wolves 3-2, which is never good if you're Villa. Lost away to Arsenal 3-1. Lost at home to West Ham 4-1. I mean, you know, I can excuse them that. You know, everyone's getting pummeled by West Ham these days. And then lost to Southampton in what you described as the Danny Ings derby. Here on a match for which Danny Ings was injured, as is regrettably too often the pattern with Danny Ings. They lost that one. And, you know, it's like the story of Villa is they lost their best player, brought in players to replace him at big... I mean, most of the money was immediately spent on Leon Bailey, Emiliano Buendia, and Danny Ings. You know, Buendia has played about half the minutes. You know, he scored one goal. Leon Bailey has played one third of the minutes. He scored one goal. You know, I mean, I remember at the time we were going, well, you know, Villa seemed quite organized. They've gone bang, bang, bang. You know, Danny Ings, of course, had a great season last season. Hasn't really produced the same form for Villa. I mean, he has been available for most of it, but three goals, maybe a little bit disappointing. You know, he hasn't maybe had the... He's no Grealish, put it that way. You know, and Watkins, who was their other kind of outstanding player last season, I guess, hasn't really gelled with him yet with Ings. So it's kind of like, you know, this team needs time to knit together. You know, the best player was taken out of it, and he kind of dictated the whole situation. And now they've got these players who are trying to find their roles within it. And very quickly, after a kind of a nosedive in form, they've decided, bang, you're gone.
Which the only thing I'll say against, yeah, I know, like, you know, he seems like quite a likable manager. The only thing I'd say against or in favour of the decision to get rid of him is that he has also spent more than 200 million net spend since the summer of 2019. But this is even accounting for the money that came in for the Jack Grealish sale. So they're in the top four, according to Transfermarkt, in the top four in that time period. So it's not as though, it's not like the Daniel Farke thing where you're doing it on a shoestring. You have been given a lot of money, a lot of players.
Who are the sides of both them on Transfermarkt?
Manchester City, Arsenal, and Man United, obviously. Man United.
Yeah, see, you know. You know, and Arteta's been through some tough times, you know, but they've obviously staked a lot on him. Pep's results, I think, have been pretty impressive.
£200 million in that period is the net spend roughly of Villa, £205 million. So.
Yeah, I mean, usually when you spend that much money, you know, there isn't going to be that much patience, even in the special circumstances about Villa.
I mean,
we've seen it happen with lots of managers. I mean, Villas Boas, I suppose, at Tottenham. Was it Villas Boas who was the manager when Bale was sold? You know, Rodgers at Liverpool when Suarez was sold. It's just difficult when you lose a player of that kind of calibre, which Grealish really was for Villa. So I guess what it comes around to now is you know, who are Villa going to appoint next? And one name that I've seen linked a lot is Steven Gerrard, who, of course, won the title with Rangers. I mean, because it's like for the reasons that you've been outlining on, this is an interesting job. Like, this is a job, or one of the rare jobs where it's a big club that actually has resources, or so far in recent seasons has been willing to kind of back their manager with resources. I mean, there are not many jobs like this, so it's got to be interesting to ambitious coaches. Gerrard has won, but I do wonder if, you know, the reservation I would have is this is clearly a job that he should be interested in taking if he wants to move up from the level of Rangers, where, let's face it, it's not going to get any better than winning the league and denying Celtic 10 in a row. You could win the league again, but it's kind of the same thing, and the 10 in a row one was the important one, really. And it's not a job with resources, which Villa is, but you're coming in sort of without a kind of a pre-season for a job which is going to be fairly decisive in terms of how you're perceived as a Premier League manager. If I was in his position, I might think I would rather take over a club where you are going to get a pre-season before you have to go into the Premier League. You know what I mean?
Well, you also told him not to take the Rangers job, though.
So. That's true. So you know, Captain Faintheart here would probably be still be managing the Liverpool under-18s. So, you know.
Captain Faintheart.
But the other one, I mean, from Faintheart to Lionheart.
Yes.
John, at John2606, Terry.
Oh, yeah.
Joined Twitter November 2021. Avatar is... I thought it would be a lion holding a Premier League trophy, which itself is top of the line. But no, it's Terry himself, which I suppose it is a lion holding a Premier League trophy. Terry is holding the Premier League trophy in front of the Chelsea supporters. What part of Stamford Bridge do you think is in the background? What specific part of Stamford Bridge?
Oh, the part that has a massive Captain Leader Legend banner?
Correct.
Nice.
Correct. And I mean, why do I bring up JT? Well, because, you know, in addition to going around dressed in sort of plus fours and Peaky Blinders hat, John Terry was recently Dean Smith's assistant before leaving to, you know, I guess follow his
join
ambitions.
Twitter.
It's no secret that he wants to be the Chelsea manager. But of course, Chelsea currently have a manager who's doing pretty well. So in the meantime, I suppose he's going to be interested in a job. Would Aston Villa be interested in going back to appoint their former assistant? I mean, just in case Terry obviously has been out of the limelight. Not that you think that looking at his Twitter feed, which is like largely him retweeting posts of people saying how awesome he is. I know I couldn't help Owen, but notice one particular post from JT Kevin Peterson. He's a cricketer, unless I'm mistaken. KP at KP24.
Yes.
A warm welcome to a captain. Is he a Chelsea fan? I mean, he must be, right? A warm welcome to a captain who would have laughed his head off at how poor Man United are! Says Kevin Peterson. Welcome to Twitter at John2606 Terry. And there's a picture there of JT holding aloft the European Cup.
Yeah.
Of course, he played really well in that final, didn't he?
Yeah.
Am I remembering that wrong? I've seen the photograph. He was obviously there. So
and underneath this, someone called David says, "Best make sure wife doesn't follow him." To which John Terry at John2606 Terry immediately responds, "You're safe, David. You are safe, David. Just seen yours on your account. Crying laughing emoji. Pig emoji." So, that's JT. 15.3k likes on that one. Who knows? It's a big. I'm sure there's lots of people who are going to be interested in that job. John Terry's only one of them, and who knows if he even is interested? Although I imagine he probably is. Now, what else is going on? I mentioned Grealish, Owen. Yeah. He couldn't even get in the Man City team.
No,
sitting there on the sideline, £100 million signing. Doesn't even get picked for the Derby game. Doesn't even get on as a sub, as Jadon Sancho at least managed to do. Pep is asked afterwards, "Why didn't you make any subs, Pep?" He says, "It was so comfortable." It's like, you know, when you're just lying in bed and you're just like, oh, I kind of want to drink water. Like, my mouth is dry, but I just couldn't be arsed. Like, actually reaching out to pick up the glass, which is like 2 feet away. I'm just too comfortable. That was Pep at Old Trafford. That's literally how... he just couldn't be bothered making his sending on Jack Grealish. So, you know, I wouldn't say this was great for Man United, but, you know, I also hesitate to sort of, to as an outsider, offer prescriptions as to what might happen. You know, of course, I mean, the Man United fans were somehow took up the cause of Donny van de Beek, weirdly, and started cheering him. And getting the biggest cheer of the day was when Donny van de Beek came on. I was like, why aren't they getting so excited about Johnny van de Beek? Donny van de Beek. This is like those QAnon people gathering in Texas to witness the coming of JFK Jr. Like, they think JFK Jr. is going to save America. It's a similar thing with van de Beek. Like, a fine player, but like, why have you fixated on him at this point? And of course, United have as usual become this like piñata. Tyson Fury says he's going to come down the training ground and smack them around with Patrice Evra, show them how to win. You know, you got to believe. You got to have belief.
Get them all in. Roy Keane, of course, says Harry Redknapp says Roy Keane should be. Just get them all down there. Get all the alphas in there. And
Lee Westwood, get him down there.
Have a proper sort out in here.
Is Lee Westwood
Old Trafford needs?
Is Lee Westwood an alpha? an alpha type. I don't know enough
like
about him.
He's a golf alpha, which means he's which is doesn't translate, I think, to a an actual alpha male.
But. Well, yeah, he had some contemptuous tweet where he was like, "Well, top sportsmen shouldn't need to be told what to do." You know, like people are always blaming Solskjaer. Like, these guys should be better than they are. So everyone is just kicking the United players as usual. You know, and then they come out and Harry Maguire apologizes, and everyone starts kicking them again. And oh wow, you know, Ole. I mean, the Ole thing did seem a little bit like kind of Brexit in the way that like the supporters are like, this is all going great, and everyone else is like, this is insane, what are you doing, you know, and there's just no agreement because they're sort of they just don't agree. The same things are just viewed in different ways. I do feel as though maybe some kind of tipping point has been reached here, not for the first time. I felt that, but Ole says the international break has come at a good time for us, and I think probably a bad time for you, to be fair. Because surely they're gonna, okay, so the other thing that happened was when all the apologies and stuff were happening, suddenly a little clip went viral starring Phil Lynch, the until now little known CEO of media at Manchester United. Now, don't confuse the CEO of media with like the press officer, the old fashioned sort of, you know, the idea of the person who kind of talks with the journalists or handles the club's press relations. The CEO of media is a blue sky thinking role. In which this individual is there to sort of reimagine what Manchester United are in terms of their media presentation to the world. Now, the reason this clip went viral, let's play the clip, because lots of people were tweeting it. Eventually, Gary Neville got onto it, and Gary Neville was like, well, let's listen to the clip first, okay, and we'll hear what Gary Neville had to say about it.
Each one of these players are individual. Someone charity focused, somewhat family focused, somewhat just football focused. And I think it's really trying to understand what narrative they want to tell. And then we're here to help support that narrative. I think, you know, it does get a little tricky sometimes because I think there's a lot of the mass media out there trying to build that story, trying to find that tabloid piece of content. That's not what we do at all. We're trying to work with them and understand the narrative and the story they want to get out. And then we support that. And we join forces on it. I think to your question about, you know, how do we work with them? We pull twice a day social media fan sentiment graphs for every single one of our players. And we have certain thresholds that alert us when we see fan sentiment going one way, whether that be a personal issue, whether that be an on-pitch performance issue. And when that happens, we then start to work with the player and his team individually to kind of try to start to counter that narrative a little bit, because in a lot of cases, you know how it is. It's just emotion and it comes up and it comes down anyway. But we do spend a lot of time on what we call social media monitoring and tracking, and then working specifically with each individual players. But again, it's 25 bespoke processes. It's not, hey, here's the game plan and it's going to work for all of you.
Yeah, so that was Man United CEO of media, Philip Lynch, speaking to Sports Pro Media's Stream Time podcast. The podcast was posted, I think, on October 27th. I'm not sure exactly when the interview was recorded, but yeah, it suddenly, what he was saying in that clip struck a chord with people. This whole idea of we pull fan sentiment graphs, and just like the comical image of United employing these like analysts who are like
unbelievable.
like
Harry Maguire scores 2-1 goals. Like, guys, I predicted Harry Maguire is going to be trending in a couple of hours. Yeah. How can we best offset this? You know, listen, I'll have a word with Harry. Knock on Harry's door. Harry, I think you're going to be trending in the next couple of hours. But don't worry, in a couple of days, it'll all have blown over. It's like, is this literally what we're talking about? Like,
That seems to be literally what was happening.
Unbelievable.
And so Neville was like, creating robots on and off the pitch, get the fuck away from them. It's a football club. He makes controlling fans sound like he's trying to win a general election. No, actually, I don't really think he's making robots out of these players, because the players, I don't think, have anything to do with it. As is evident when you see Bruno Fernandes tweeting, good vibes, with a photo of Gabriel Martinelli and like Emil Smith Rowe and a couple of other Arsenal players hugging and jumping up and down, and then deleting that, and then the same post appearing on Martinelli's account. Like,
what? Moments.
Yeah.
No.
Like, I mean, Bruno's post was good vibes.
We all had a picture of Holly Arsenal.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, it was obviously they were logged into the wrong account. So that's how much these players have to do with it, right? And what you have is there's so much money in football that you've got all of these like ancillary staff who are like in charge of everything to do with the players. Like, for instance, Daniel Sturridge, who recently moved out to play for Perth Glory in Australia, and maybe he needs to reassemble the usual staff. I see his he's put a post up. Need a barber in Perth, Western Australia, Thursday. Only put your CV forward if you're top level. You see the vibes, crispy clean, smooth, like I wash my face with cake soap. If you've never cut hair like mine, don't bother putting your CV forward. My hairline is important to me. It's straight. I don't want to leave Australia with an M-head hairline. Please proceed to put your CV forward if, after all I've said, you still fit the description. Top level craftsmanship, barber level on 1,000, but don't charge anywhere near that much. If you do, you're out the running. Shaky hands, I rebuke you. Don't bluff me. I'm going to look in your profile. If your pics ain't good, don't bother putting your CV forward. You're out the running. I had time to today. Well, I have time every day. I'm in quarantine still. Bye for now. So, you know, again, there's a big job going there. Daniel Sturridge is hairstylist, right? Football players have got a lot of money. They've now got a lot of employees, chef, you know, stylist, physio, lawyer, agent, accountant, social media manager, right? These guys have to do something. They have to liaise with the media people at Man United, and everyone is sort of justifying their existence and, you know, justifying the little slice of this massive pie of cash that, you know, they're all sort of feasting on. What I found more interesting about this was not the oh my god, they're turning the players into robots. As when I listened to the actual full podcast interview with Phil Lynch, some of the stuff he said about how Man United sort of conceive of themselves, I thought was interesting. So he starts off talking about how United have it's all about, like, since he's been there, which is about 5 years, the big shift has been towards owned and operated stuff. So rather than like looking at all their social media stuff, which is run by like Twitter, Facebook, you know, Instagram, whatever, who give you lots of data but also keep lots of data for themselves, they're looking to try to get their fans onto their own app, you know, the mobile phone app, so they can get all the data themselves. It's not like some social media company is kind of hiding a lot of the information they want to know. So if you want to really run a surveillance capitalist business, you need to have your own app. And that's the big shift that Man United have been doing now. You know, you can mine that data to provide insight. There was a great quote towards the end. I want you to engage with the content. I want to build a relationship with you. It's just that kind of organic, natural evolution of a relationship. And then, you know, as we start to have that relationship, we get more and more data from it. And then we can start serving you specific content you like. So,
tale is old as time, isn't it? You know, when you think back, you know, like the Adam and Eve. You know, from Adam and Eve to here, this is what relationships are all about.
Just
harvesting,
you know,
your data.
Harvesting data and then, you know, putting the right offer in front of the right user at the right time. It's kind of a waste of an impression to, you know, if your favorite player is Bruno Fernandes, to offer you a shirt of, you know, Aaron Wan-Bissaka. You know what I mean? So I just want to give you Bruno Fernandes stuff. But like, I remember Richard Arnold years ago at the Web Summit talking about how United are the biggest TV show in the world, which at the time was like, oh, you know, this is sort of interesting. Like, they're kind of seeing themselves in a different way. It's not like they were always paying lip service to the idea, well, we're fundamentally a football club. It's about winning matches. And Phil Lynch still does the same thing. But really, they were kind of a TV show, and it was focused on selling ads. You know, like, we're this massive attention attracting entity, and that makes us a valuable property for sponsors. You know, so that's how we make our money. We're the biggest TV show in the world. Phil Lynch sees them not as the show, but as a platform, right? So they're not a show on Netflix. They are Netflix. Right, this is the difference. So, like, so an OTT media service is what he's describing them as, over-the-top media service, which is, say, something like Netflix or Amazon Prime or Disney Plus, or one of these kind of subscription-type services that provides tons of content for you to watch, right? So, you know, Man United is no longer the show. They don't think of themselves as a TV show. They think of themselves as, like, the platform. And maybe the players are, like, the shows. So maybe, like, Ronaldo joined... This is not something that he said, but maybe, you know, like, when Ronaldo joins United, that's kind of like Netflix signing Seinfeld. You know what I mean? Like, oh, you can watch all the Seinfeld episodes now. Oh, this is amazing. You know, here's a golden oldie. You know, he did talk specifically about, if we're going to engage that individual for competing against Netflix and Amazon, we're all competing for the same amount of time, right? So the thing that hasn't changed is they still see themselves fundamentally as an entertainment industry thing, right?
As opposed to a football club that needs to win football matches.
Is it really entertainment? This gets to the fundamental problem that United have. Like, they see themselves as players in the entertainment industry, but is this really about entertainment? And I actually don't think that it is. I mean, like, he started talking about the fans, and okay, so their definition of fans, 1.1 billion fans and followers, right? Which, okay. And he says this, we divide it into about seven main cohorts, from our best diehard fans in the Stretford End to the casual neutral fan who might support three or four other clubs. Right? So I mean, that casual neutral fan, that's not a fan, right? In my understanding of it, but it's basically someone who's aware of Manchester United and like might watch a football match, you know. And I assume that the cohorts in between those must include passionate haters of Manchester United who wish them ill at all points. But those people are like really engaged.
They're watching.
Followers. Yeah. You know, so it's kind of interesting that like decisions are being taken based on what this whole group of people wants. Not just this small vocal group who are actually in the stadium, you know, screaming for Donny Van Beek, but like 1.1 billion fans and followers. But I would suggest that even those people are not really watching for entertainment, right? They're watching because they hope for United to win or to lose. That's what they're looking for. It's about winning and losing, right? That's the actual thing that's important about football, or that people are excited about, not entertainment. And you might now go, Kieran, I'm surprised that you haven't already gone, Hang on a second. Are you not the guy who was telling us that winning is an illusion, that it's all about like the style of play? You know, Stephen Kenny is going to lead the troops again against Portugal in a couple of days.
No, I get the point that you're making. You don't watch Man United in the same way that you watch an old episode of Seinfeld on Netflix.
No.
That's a fundamental misunderstanding of what football... Football matters to people in a way that's very different to, you know, watching, you know, the latest episode of Succession. I mean, you know, I'm interested in watching the latest episode of Succession, but I mean, I'm not emotionally invested.
Oh my god, I am so emotionally invested in Succession. So and only dying to see who emerges on top. No spoilers.
Yeah, but no, you're not going to I'm sickened by this. Like, you know, I've had it about up to here with Shiv. Like, she's got to go. Like, you know, people would be with Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain yesterday. Like, it's just, you know, it's not the same thing.
Yeah, well, there have been one or two developments in the Shiv storyline that have annoyed
but
me.
If you watch a terrible episode of Succession, do you feel like in a foul mood for 3 days after?
No,
you sit down and watch an episode of Succession that you like or dislike. You really enjoy it. And if it's not good and you don't like it, then you just go, oh, that was pretty bad.
You really have a fundamental misunderstanding of how engaged I am by Succession at the moment, guys.
Continue.
Okay, well, maybe I picked the wrong example. How about any other TV show you've ever watched up until now other than Succession? I mean, like, the Game of Thrones is actually a very good example in that, like, the last three or four episodes of Game of Thrones were terrible. And people sat down and watched them, and they're like, oh, God, that was such a disappointment. And then we just all decided as a culture to just stop mentioning Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, listen, we liked it, but now it's... Oh. It's
all people right. got really anymore, people got it. Really head up over that last episode.
Yeah, but then...
It was
then
a disgrace, to be fair. It was an absolute disgrace.
But then it just...
I don't agree.
Then it just disappeared. Everyone was just like, oh, yeah, Game of Thrones. Yeah, that was... What were we all thinking?
But you see, it's not just about whether they win or whether they lose and hate watching or watching only to win, because... If you think about it, like, I don't remember the Van Gaal era, for example, having quite as much emotion around it as this one. It seems like a lot more emote. It is about stories. It is about the fact that Solskjaer is there as the ex-United legend. There is a sort of reality TV or soap opera element to the whole thing over and above just whether or not they win or lose a game, no?
Yeah, and I don't know how much of that is happening because of these Svengalis, you know, these impresarios behind the scenes who are controlling the narrative and, you know, prodding us, pushing our emotional buttons. I mean, maybe that is going on. Like,
I have a question for this social media genius, Philip Lynch.
Yeah.
Philip.
Media, not social media, more general media,
yes,
but yes,
of course. Yeah. Philip, obviously, you know, you've spent a lot of time working in the social media sphere. Did you ever think before doing this interview that social media might get quite annoyed at the idea that you are going out here creating a narrative for other human beings that people actually care about? So, I mean, whether or not you're doing a good job, it seems a little odd for you to go and do a victory lap on something that is being universally panned by all of your 1.1 billion followers, or casual or otherwise.
Users.
Hey, Philip, one of your 1.1 billion users here, you're doing a terrible job, and I don't appreciate you describing how terrible your job is.
Philip, I preferred you when I had no idea that you existed.
You and the job that you're doing existed.
There is an element of that. But, you know, I mean, I think, like I feel a bit sorry for Philip because he was a bit exposed. Like, the thing sort of came out at a bad time, or like, obviously it caught fire. It went viral at a moment when everyone was like, you know, going nuts about all the stupid apologies and that.
Yeah, but, I mean, people were going nuts about Man United players coming out and apologising a long time before October the 26th. This has been a thing.
The podcast got posted in 2017. Who knows? Maybe it had been in the can for ages. Maybe he never would have done it, you know, if he knew these results were going to happen. I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. But, you know, like, a lot of
what
he
could possibly have expected the Manchester results would.
This is the thing. They never seem to think about the results. You know, and this is the problem. Like, I mean, okay. Like, I'm not. You may think there's an inconsistency here because, like, oh, didn't Jose Mourinho go on about results and you were panning him and now you're saying, oh, it's all about results? No, it is about results. Part of the charm of football is all the disagreement that people have over the best ways to get results. The one thing everyone agrees on is that the objective is to win. But people have different ideas about the best way of doing that. And that's where you get this whole argument between, you know, progressive and reactive styles, you know, because there are some people who think, well, you know, we should work together to try to, you know, make creative attacking moves and score goals. We should teamwork, you know, we can try things, we can make a plan, we can work together. And there are other people who are like, no, you can't make a plan, you know, human perfectibility is an illusion, you know, you're a bunch of self-deluding idiots. You're the only capacity you have is for vanity. The only way to play is to wait for these people who fancy themselves so much to trip up and make a mistake. Then we pounce on that mistake and we score. Right. So there, you know, there's a dichotomy there, and there's a lot of space to argue. But everyone agrees winning is ultimately what you want to do. It's just they disagree about the best way to win. And this is the thing.
Listen, I love calling you a hypocrite more than literally anything else in the world. Yeah. But I don't think Philip Lynch and Jose Mourinho's playing style amount to any sort of a contradiction. That's, you know, like,
no, they don't, because he's sort of, they're sort of looking beyond, they're not realizing how important winning and losing is. They've been given this massive fan base and they think it's something to do with like the romance of the club, but like, you're leaving out Ferguson winning for decades.
But of course, you know, it's like the romance of the club, otherwise every United fan would be hounding Ole Gunnar Solskjaer out of a job. It's only the romance of the job, romance of the club keeping him in that position.
I don't follow. I mean, I'm talking about why do United have 1.1 billion fans and followers? Like, I think it has a lot to do with decades of winning under Alex Ferguson. You know what I mean? I think winning is, you can't, like, you know, entertaining football, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, Eric Cantona, all that kind of stuff, but like winning as well, you know, I mean, they entertained and also won. But, you know, if it is just about entertainment, I mean, there is only one place for them to go after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, assuming they do want to make change. I mean, if the social media is suggesting fans seem to be annoyed, there's only one guy out there, and
Moyes?
It's not David Moyes. There's a hotter show out there in the world of content creation, even than the Ronaldo Seinfeld show in English football. Who is the hottest influencer, creator of media in English football today?
He happens to be
a Manchester United legend. He happens to
Roy Keane.
It's Keane. I mean, can you imagine what would happen if Keane was to take over at Manchester United? I mean, I know they're saying we don't really monetize social media. It's not about counting likes anymore. But we've never seen this many likes. Like, every one of those 1.1 billion followers, haters, users is going to be getting on there and liking this. And like, fires are going to be breaking out at Instagram data servers all over the world. Like, if Keane, and I've kind of reached the point now where I always thought that Keane coming in, and I did sort of slightly regret watching him on Sky just slating like half the team. I was like, that's too many. You've gone through 6 out of the 11 players. Like, it's hard to imagine you taking over now, or at least in the next couple of weeks. You know, there's always this thing of, well, maybe, you know, his coaching career hasn't been that great and there's no reason to think it would be great. But could it be worse than what's actually been going on?
Yeah.
What you think doesn't really matter.
Good, but like,
yeah,
is that
I think
bad?
Could, yeah.
Is that bad though? Let's
well,
leave
we'd
it on
be
that
watching,
question.
You know,
it would.
I mean,
it could be worse, but would it be? It would have greater intensity, and would it ultimately be worse? Who can say?
Well, did you see him having his argument with a supporter yesterday on the way out of the ground?
I certainly did.
Yeah.
And again, you know, this is my appetite for Roy Keane Condit is insatiable. I'm not the only one. And just the union of these two great brands, you know, the arrival of Roy Keane on the platform of Manchester United, I just think we're talking about opening up a whole new frontier in entertainment.
It's very difficult to see Arsenal play one day without Arsenal on the bench.
He's going to ruin the club, fam. He's going to ruin the club, lad. I'm telling you, fam.
But up and down the land, you do sense a genuine appreciation for the way this Arsenal team play. They were perfect.
It's turning. It's turning, blood. Did you hear the boos at full time? Seriously, shut the fuck up tonight. We're not in no mood for no little dickheads chatting shit.
We love to have him there all the time, but we all know that's not going to happen. One day he's going to have to go.
Spineless, where were they in the second half? Spineless, no fucking character, no fucking leadership. Where does that boil down to? It boils down to the fucking manager. He's finished.
It will be hard. He's not thinking of leaving one day.
He was a great manager. He's gone.
It will happen eventually. We all know it. But I don't see it.
Arsenal Football Club, then.
For me, the day I will see Arsenal play without Arsene on the bench, it's going to be weird.
The fan base of this fucking club.
Don't try to
have
to
be full.
Don't try to question my fan base. Don't try to question my fan base, okay?
The fan base, all right, listen. I can't get angry like I have before because it's just.
Arsene Wenger's team, every bit as good as the manager's words. He had no doubts. They are the champions. They have taken the title away from Manchester United, and they have done it here at Old Trafford. It does not get more conclusive than that.
Miguel Delaney of The Independent and The Guardian's Jacob Steinberg this week for our last Premier League chat before the international break. Miguel, how are you?
Not too bad, thanks.
Good, good, good. Jacob, how are things?
All good, thanks.
Things are good for West Ham, Jacob, after events yesterday. I mean, there have been quite a few good days under David Moyes in the second spell as West Ham manager. Was this one comfortably the best yet?
Certainly up there. I mean, obviously, David Moyes had his 1,000th game last week when they drew with Genk in the Europa League. So, you know, this is a good moment for David Moyes and proving a lot of people wrong after the way that he's come back and, you know, looked so resurgent since returning to West Ham in just under 2 years ago. Everything really has gone right since then for him. You know, he's very quickly turned them into one of the best sides in the Premier League, which is a massive surprise given where they were when he took over. You know, and he himself has said in that he did a few interviews last week, you know, for his 1,000th game, which was a big moment for him, and said that, you know, probably would have expected it to take a little bit longer than it has. I think there was a point which he said that if West Ham fan, if it had taken maybe 6 years for this to happen, probably West Ham fans would have accepted it because they would have seen a gradual build. So for it to happen in 2 years is just a massive surprise and a massive bonus. And the sort of the weird disarming thing about it is that yesterday wasn't a massive surprise. I mean, I didn't think that they would beat Liverpool given the run that Liverpool were on and how well Salah was playing and the fact that they hadn't beaten Liverpool for almost 6 years, you know, which was going back into the Bilic era, very at the start of the Klopp era at Liverpool. And instead they fully deserved it yesterday. I don't think that there could be any arguments about the about the result. Obviously, there'll be a few gripes about a couple of the decisions, but on the balance of play, the way that the second half turned out after, I don't think West Ham were particularly good in the first half, but the way that the second half panned out, I don't think that there could be any complaints about what happened.
Yeah, Jurgen Klopp definitely had one or two gripes about decisions, all right, Miguel. But just on the bigger picture of what West Ham produced yesterday and what they've been doing, what is Moyes doing with them? What impresses you about what they're producing at the moment?
Well, they do. I mean, I know a lot of people are saying it, but it's hard to escape the comparison. They do remind me of a lot of the best of his Everton, which is really hard to break down, but also are really quite spiky in attack and know exactly when to attack. So they're quite a compact unit, but know how to hurt you in a variety of different ways. Obviously, I suppose the one that stood out on Sunday was set pieces, but there's much more to them than that. And it's just these constant sharp bursts that are pretty hard to live with. And of course, there's so many good players on form. Rice and Suchek form the centre of that really strong base. And from there, there's just it's a really solid platform. And they're quite distinctive in the Premier League like that as well. I think Moy, I suppose you wouldn't exactly call him a tactical visionary or anything like that. But what he's doing now, it is quite distinctive in the Premier League. There's not too many teams. In fact, I think they're unique, really.
In what sense? So what do you mean by that? Yeah.
Well, I do think within the Premier League now, we're going through a little bit of football is in a kind of a wider evolution where, and you could even see it with, say, Newcastle's or what clubs like Villa and Newcastle want to do next. Even Newcastle going to a manager like Eddie Howe, Villa looking to take the next step. And I think it's generally good for the game. We're all going towards a more progressive approach of football. Obviously, it's all high pressing, close to possession. And Moyes almost, not that he's a throwback in that, but suddenly someone doing something in a slightly different way with some kind of maybe older fashioned principles, but honed and brought on a lot, makes all the more of a difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Jacob, you were saying that Moyes has sort of surprised a few people or proved a lot of people wrong. I don't think you're among that number. I mean, if I recall correctly, you were in favour of Moyes coming back, which a lot of people were, why are we doing this? It's a terrible idea. Or in favour of him coming in, thought, praised what he was doing at the time. So I guess you're not surprised by the fact that it's been successful. But I wonder, when you look at what's happened over the last few years, is the big moment here not so much the return of Moyes as the rise of Declan Rice?
I mean, I was sceptical when he joined the first time in November 2017, David Moyes, because obviously what had gone on before then in his career wasn't particularly encouraging. And, but gradually over that 6-month period that he was there, he kept them up and you could see progress that was coming. And I thought that, if he was able to do something that he had achieved at Everton at West Ham, which is a similar kind of club, then it would turn out to be good for them. And I was annoyed when he left, and I thought it was a mistake. And who knows where they might have been if they'd not had those 2 years with Pellegrini. It was a bit of a waste of time. So I wasn't particularly surprised when he came back that he was able to settle quickly and do well, because it was really a case of picking up where he left off. But yeah, I mean, Declan Rice. Again, I'm not surprised to see how well he's playing. It was pretty obvious when he came into the team as a teenager. He made a few mistakes at the start, as you would expect, because he was young and inexperienced, and was pulled in and out of the side at times by Bilic and Pellegrini. There was a point at which Moyes hammered him after a particularly bad mistake at Arsenal, where he ducked under a cross and let it go in. Bad communication, the kind of thing that...
Well, sorry, what did Moyes do there? Was that a public hammering?
That was in the first time. Yeah, it was in the first... It was during his first spell, and they lost 4-1 at Arsenal. It was just after... It was like 2 days after Wenger had said he was leaving, and it was 1-1, and a very tame cross came in, and Declan Rice, who was playing as a centre-back that day, just inexplicably decided to duck under the ball, and it crept in at the far post with Joe Hart... looking quite sad in goal as it went past him, and Moyes just came out and hammered him publicly, and he got you know, at that point, people thought, "What, you know, with Moyes, what are you doing? You know, it's this is totally
you can't do that. You can't do that to players."
Yeah, but then people who would know Rice better would say, actually, he's exactly the kind of guy who can take it. He's a very quick learner. He won't let that affect him. He'll bounce back from it, and that's happened repeatedly with him. That he has not. It's not been all plain sailing all the way through. He can go back to the start of his career. He obviously was let go by Chelsea, and that was devastating for him when he was 14. He's had moments where Pellegrini dropped him at the start of his time at West Ham, and he was pulled out of the team after a hammering at Anfield, and very quickly proved that was a mistake by Pellegrini. Before Moyes returned to West Ham, Rice was really struggling. He wasn't playing well at all. The team under Pellegrini was, you know, tactically all over the place, and Rice looked very exposed in midfield, and people at the time were saying, "Is this guy as good as he's really made out to be and everything?" And since then, since Moyes has come in, he's gone from strength to strength. You know, again, there's you get the questions, particularly during the summer with Rice, around England, whether or not he was able, you know, is he a good enough passer? Can he carry the ball? Does he score enough? And that's just been answered again, the way that he's playing this season, the way that he's taken his game on. You know, I heard you guys obviously talking last week about the Vieira and Toure comparisons, and you know, the fact that Declan Rice wants to be like those players, and you can see in his game that he's carrying it forward, the way that he brings the ball out, the switches of play that he's able to produce, the passing is quick and snappy and incisive. It's going to be very interesting to see, you know, how he progresses. And I think, you know, that one sort of note of caution for West Ham is sort of one of those points at which you wonder just how crucial he is to them, and how long they can hold on to him, what happens when he leaves. You know, you might look at what's happened at Aston Villa and their struggle to, you know, use the £100 million they got for Jack Grealish effectively. Yeah. And, you know, you'd imagine it'll be a similar kind of price for Declan Rice, and, how they'll be able to respond when that happens. Because I would be quite surprised, to be honest, if he is a West Ham player next season.
Really? So, I mean, I can see him staying at West Ham if they stay in the Champions League, for instance. I mean, but, Miguel, I want to bring you in here. There's a couple of issues with Rice. Number one, what Jacob has just touched on there, whether he'll still be at West Ham. I mean, if they get Champions League, I can see him staying, certainly for another season. But if not, maybe it's difficult, especially when you see him sort of dominating games such as against Liverpool. I can think of a couple of other teams currently in the Premier League who might like to have a player like that in their team. The other issue with Rice, which puzzles me, it's good, it's not an issue. It's like, how is he the only one who's immune from whatever has happened to all of the other England Euro 2020 players?
I was about to add that. Yeah, it's basically him and Phil Foden are really the only exception. Foden's obviously not to the level of Rice, but also Foden didn't play as much during the summer. In terms of that summer and signings, Jacob mentioned there about recovering from setbacks. It obviously wasn't to Harry Kane's level, but Rice did want to go in the summer. Some of Manchester United thought they would get him this summer. Solskjaer felt at various points it was possible, and of course this feeds into the wider debate about Ronaldo, where had money been, or some of the budget been directed towards a big move for Rice, or the 100 million it would have taken, although it could have been even higher than that, then Solskjaer's idea of the team, his Ronaldo-less idea of the team, would have been completed, and you know, United might have gone in a very different direction. He didn't get it, but there was obviously none of the situation we've seen with Kane. Now, of course, Rice is a lot younger than Kane, and there's much more of his career to go and much more time. At the moment, going into next season, looks like he might be playing more Champions League football. But I think it does come down to, I mean, as to why he's one of the few England players playing well, I think it's probably two things. I mean, one is possibly just the physical effect of it all, especially given Rice in the summer would have been one of the few England players who had European football. So essentially he's got much, much fewer minutes on the clock into this year. There's also probably the mental effect, which is kind of, because this has happened to a lot of teams who've gone back to, I remember Italy 94, and like one of my first tournament memories in that regard. where a team goes so close to the final, there is actually a hangover. Now, I think a lot of people expected it to be with Southgate's team. That hasn't happened. Some of it's probably down to how forgiving the group is. But it has happened to players individually, where I think pretty much every member of Southgate's best 11 or best 15, bar Rice or Foden, is kind of just having a bad season. You know, even we mentioned United there, but Shaw and Maguire are probably two of the most prominent examples, especially given Shaw had such a resurgent Euro 2020 and how he was arguably one of the players of the tournament. And so as to why, I think it is a mix of, you know, the physical effects, which Rice has mostly been immune from, and also I think something to do in his, maybe as Jake has pointed it there, in his personality. He's recovered from setbacks. He didn't allow any refusal to tell him to go to Manchester United to get to his head, and he kind of just got on. And as well as that, he's in quite a good club situation generally, where he's come back and got locked in to what is a strong atmosphere nurtured by Moyes. I was one of those who doubted him many times. And hence, we're seeing one of the outstanding players in the Premier League right now.
Yeah,
and I think you're right. Just on that, I mean, my thinking would be if they get to the Champions League, he'd at least give West Ham a Champions League season. But I mean, I suppose just to maybe throw something into this whole discussion, although this has been said for the last year, I suppose my instinct is still that it will level out, and West Ham will still have a good season, but maybe not necessarily a top four season.
Yeah, we'll see. They were close enough to it last year. But just on Liverpool, Declan Rice could well fit into that midfield. You could see they look a little bit light there now, Miguel, and especially when the injuries start hitting. Like, it's a funny one to start talking too negatively about Liverpool. They have just been on a record break, a historic unbeaten run. But even Jurgen Klopp acknowledged there were a lot of draws in there as well. It didn't necessarily feel like they were being dominant, and they failed to win 5 out of the last 11 games. Are there a few issues that were exposed by West Ham, do you think?
Well, it feels like the defence hasn't really been restored yet. And Klopp has actually had not a few snipes, but almost kind of marking Virgil van Dijk's card a few times. You talked of the body language last week against Brighton. And it's quite odd, Liverpool. I mean, if you take out the horror run that they had in January, February, which I think was primarily down to injuries and just key areas of the team being completely gutted. If you take that, because I think that was a freak. Mm. But even if you go back to the first few months of last season, they had this in them as well, where it felt like they had this really high top level. Weirdly, the standout one remains for me, their performance against Crystal Palace last December, which is just before this drop-off. And we've seen them go close to that many times. In fact, the 5-0 against Manchester United, I didn't think was that close. I was there that day and actually bizarrely didn't think they were that good on the day. They were kind of slack. But they have had so many moments this season where you kind of look at them and think, well, this is probably Europe's best team right now. But yet within a week or within the same spell of form, they do have this capacity to suddenly get drop off. And also, as became so prominent yesterday, they can suddenly be just cut open. I mean, I suppose delve into my dull Sunday. I was disassembling a flat pack yesterday and had the game on in the background. And there was a certain point in the second half though where it felt every time I looked up, West Ham were on a 2-on-2. And that's been the case a few times this season in Liverpool games.
Yeah, I thought Jacob, a big moment of the game was right at the very beginning when that situation was created where Michel Antonio was going one-on-one against Van Dijk, and everyone in the stadium could see Michel Antonio has the beatings of Virgil van Dijk. I mean, this is Van Dijk conceded the corner, and that's where the first goal came from. But it sort of set the tone immediately for the game. It's like Van Dijk can't dominate those situations the way that he used to before his injury.
Yeah, I mean, the goals that West Ham scored, you wouldn't have expected them to happen during the title-winning season with Liverpool. You would expect Virgil van Dijk to have, you know, mopped up a few of those situations, to probably have been the player dominating the area when, you know, from the corners that West Ham scored from, to maybe just spread a bit more calm about the defence and to have dealt with the counter-attacks. Because, you know, the big part of that team, wasn't it, was that the fullbacks were able to push so high and trust that Van Dijk would be there to, you know, just keep everything ticking over at the back. And that yesterday certainly didn't seem to be something that functioned that well. I think another issue for Liverpool remains the right-back area where obviously you get so much from Trent Alexander-Arnold going forward. On the ball, I thought he had a good game. He was dangerous. I think he was involved, wasn't he, in the second goal for Origi?
He's involved in the
and obviously goal. that amazing free kick to bring it level, when I thought probably this would be where Liverpool would then kick on and go on and win, and instead that seemed to do West Ham a favour, because they hadn't been playing that well, and the counter attack hadn't really been functioning. But there was that moment in the straight after the equaliser where they popped the ball over Alexander Arnold's head, and he didn't defend it at all well, and Benrahma got in, and it was Van Dijk who came up with a good tackle on Jarrod Bowen when it looked like they were going to score. I think that's been a problem that famously was in the Real Madrid quarterfinal, where Cruz was putting those long balls over Alexander Arnold's head, and he wasn't dealing with them. So that's that one aspect of his defending there, which teams seem to identify, and West Ham seemed to pick out yesterday. And then just more obviously was the fact that they were very obviously targeting the space that he leaves down the right when he goes forward. And they were getting them over and over again on the counter attack. I thought as well the midfield was a bit prosaic, a bit mundane. I thought eventually, as it wore on, they just got overpowered by Rice and Suchek. You didn't see a lot from Oxlade-Chamberlain, I thought, and eventually came on, and obviously Thiago came on, and again, you're still waiting for him to really show the form that he produced at Bayern Munich. There were a lot of passes that just seemed to go towards nobody, really. There are a few issues, and obviously they have the Africa Cup of Nations coming up, when they're going to lose the main source of goals. The bench looked a little bit light yesterday for Liverpool as well.
Yeah, I think you're depressing the hell out of any Liverpool fans.
As Moyes pointed out, I thought Liverpool played some great stuff.
He was basking in the reflected glory of the great stuff.
Well, 3 days early, they were playing Atletico Madrid off the park, weren't they? So it is that top level that they seem to hit, as Miguel says.
It does feel, though, for me, I think it still will be a rare three-way title race. But it does feel a little bit of a kind of rock, paper, scissors element to it, where all the three, they're all strong in their own specific way, but each of them also has a bit of a prominent weakness right now. I mean, Liverpool seem to waver so much, and the issue is how they could open. City, who actually in big games, they've been absolutely superb with the way they've been on it and got absolutely right. But weirdly, that kind of translates into these kind of really frustrating matches against teams lower down the table because of that lack of a striker, where it's almost as if they don't have the same game plan without a striker. It doesn't work, and they struggle much more to open up. So they have so many games where they can either go where they cut someone open after scoring early, or else they have these long frustrating games that go into the kind of 70th, 80th minute, and suddenly there's this anxiety around. And that happened a lot to Barca in Guardiola's fourth season there in 11-12. And in Chelsea, you have probably the strongest strength and depth, but their absolute top level as a team doesn't seem quite as high yet as City or Liverpool, but maybe they'll have more consistency over the long run. But because of all that, though, I do think it'll be a three-way that goes the distance, and hopefully, because it's been...
It's interesting. I mean, as a prospect, I mean, it's not something we've seen for a long time. I do wonder, though, Miguel, if maybe it's time for, given what Jacob was saying, I hadn't thought about it like this before, but maybe it is time for Trent Alexander-Arnold to go on Instagram and apologize for what he's been doing, because a lot of players are doing it now. I mean, it's become a huge thing, especially surrounding the Man United players, because they've had this sequence of defeats and the sequence of apologies, and the reaction just keeps getting more and more angry, but they just keep doing it. Why do you think players do this now? What is the point of doing it?
Well, first of all, it's supposed to, I suppose, foster some sort of connection with the fans. And or really, it's about engagement with their social media channels. And I think by this point, we can't escape the primary reason for it. We've all seen by now that podcast or that interview that went up, that went around on Saturday. I think it's from
Phil Lynch, CEO of Media. Yeah. We've played a couple of bits of it. Yeah,
yeah, which is ultimately about controlling the narrative. And I think Gary Neville put it well on Sunday night. It's looking at fan response to games and dealing with it as if it's some sort of election campaign. You know, as if you can nuance the opinion polls, which is obviously nonsense because we keep coming back to the reality of results. And this kind of that essence of reality is what this comes down to. Because say if Trent Alexander-Arnold did feel like he had to have an apology.
I just want to point out, I don't actually feel Trent Alexander-Arnold should apologize, but please continue the thought.
But just in the sense that if he did it once, that would be fine, I think, because that would be, if it's every so often, or infrequent, or even if it only happens once, it at least feels a bit more authentic, because this is what this comes down to. Yeah, I think the sense, especially when the Manchester United players are doing it in the same way, with the same language, after every game, it just feels inauthentic, or as if it's a box-ticking exercise, which kind of obviously plays into the whole wider discussion about how much of these accounts are actually the player's voice.
Is it because is it because they need to, like, if you think about it, right, it seems kind of nuts that they're doing this. Like, you know, can they not see that people just get annoyed by this? But if they don't do it, what happens then? Like, say if they just
Does anyone care?
Well, if they don't, if they don't acknowledge any bad performance or don't refer to anything bad that happens on their social media, do they then not sort of get criticized for that? It's like, does that absence not then get pointed out by all of the people who are like atting them and saying, you know, where were you? And or the next time they go on to like post about their new digital collectible, right? They're like plugging their NFTs. All the replies are going to be, where were you after the 5-0?
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's the only time it becomes a problem, if they immediately, and I suppose somewhat clumsily, had some sort of sponsored post or one of these usuals, or as you say, you know, their NFT immediately afterwards. But if there's a bit of space between it, I don't think people, I mean, this is something that came up in the discussion after the game as well. You know, the football news cycle moves very quickly these days. And also, look, it did feel like at this point, more people were attuned, more United fans, just judging from social media, were critical of those who tweeted after the game, whereas no one really cared about anyone who didn't. And if some of those who didn't then, you know, tweeted their usual stuff on Tuesday or Wednesday, I don't think anyone would be particularly bothered. It feels like the whole, you're right in the sense that if players tweet at the wrong time and not acknowledge the defeat, that would create a reaction. But it feels in generally the whole tone of this has shifted. And just there's a real resistance to this. And I think there's a resistance just because it doesn't feel authentic. It doesn't feel real. And this does go beyond, I think, social media. Even before Twitter, we can remember the days where, you know, it would all be like, I remember actually so many Arsenal defeats under Wenger, big around that kind of 2010 to 2014 period, which was just as Twitter was taking off, to be fair. And the big discussion after every game was, we've no leaders in the team now to front up after a defeat. And I mean, we'd be in mixed zones after the European games, and always be Per Mertesacker who came out to try and explain this. And Mertesacker was actually quite authentic in the way he spoke. But there'd be an interview on Arsenal.com 2 days later, which was just, again, the same message every time. And people get sick of that.
Yeah,
because it doesn't feel, it's addressing defeats and setbacks, but it's not really truly addressing it. It becomes a box ticking exercise, and I think that's what people are just resistant about. And it's all the more ironic, given this is supposed to be, these social media accounts are supposed to be about fostering the connection between players and fans and all the rest of it. But it feels like they kind of do the opposite now. And one final point for like Jacob in there, sorry, like this isn't either a criticism of players having social media teams that I know kind of Gary Neville and Roy Keane don't like. I don't think there's anything wrong with a player basically working with people to just so he expresses himself in the way he'd want. But that's where the distinction needs to be. It should still be obviously the player speaking in some way and not just someone on a social media team like getting the okay, yeah, put up something, because it does happen, and they put up some kind of, you know, bland meme almost at this point.
Yeah, I mean, although it's interesting that you refer to that period of Arsenal, because the other thing that I recall about that Arsenal time, sort of early days of social media and that sort of late Wenger team was the way that they would post pictures of celebrations after the most mundane events. You know, like they were constantly getting hammered for like, oh, here's all the Arsenal players partying in the dressing room after like beating Southampton 2-1 at home. Or, you know what I mean? Like, it was like, oh, these guys think they've won the cup final. That was the kind of the thing that was always said about them. So I was wondering, Jacob, in this, like, is these sort of apologies the players are getting criticized for now, is this not just sort of the flip side of all of the, like, let's say, positive social media engagement that they do? Like, say, for instance, when Declan Rice takes his phone and starts, like, dancing in the West Ham dressing room and puts this up and everyone is, like, loving this and it's amazing. It's like... This is just the other side of that. Like, if you want to do that, you then have to sort of come out with this, oh, we're so sorry about the defeat, you know, when the defeats inevitably come.
I don't know. I'm both a football fan and a journalist, and I also have a Twitter account, and so I follow these players on social media, partly for work and partly for just, you know, following what they say and sometimes, yes, sometimes amusement. And were they to have lost yesterday, West Ham, I wouldn't have been glued to my phone waiting for the moment when one of them, Craig Dawson, came out to apologise for, you know, letting Diogo Jota through or something like that. I don't really understand why that would be a part of the deal, part of the fan experience.
So why do you think that? Why do you think that? We've been listening to Miguel explain why he thinks. Why do you think so many of them feel this is a this is something that they should be doing, or at least the people who are controlling their social media accounts have persuaded them this is something they need to do. Why?
Well, why they? I mean, you've got the answer of why they from the guy at United of why they feel they need to do these things, and you know it's all about making sure that they, you know, that they when trends are happening that they approach them head on and make sure that they don't spiral out of hand. You know, I guess part of it is, I wonder if part of it, if there's an element of, you know, as soon, you see it, you hear about a lot of the players as soon as they get on the team bus after the game and everything, a lot of them, you hear about younger players certainly, they're straight onto their phone and looking at what happened, what the response might be, should it have been a defeat after the game, and looking at their mentions and everything else, and probably they see quite a lot of bad stuff coming towards them, and especially if you're at a big club, that must be quite overwhelming at times. And I wonder if there's an element of just wondering if you need to tackle that head on and make sure that, you know, you get your apology out and tackle that. But I just don't see the point of it. I don't think that it comes across as inauthentic. I saw Eric Bailly, his one, and it was like it just seemed like flogging himself in public because it was
the photograph. Yeah. He put a couple of pictures up of his own goal. Yeah.
Oh no.
It was bizarre. So yeah.
That was next level stuff from him. All right. Miguel, is there any fear of Manchester United's twice daily readings of social media sentiment might lead them to conclude that some people feel it might be time to change the manager? I know you were writing in your most recent piece that I've read anyway, that they're sticking tight and that there won't be a change over the course of this international break. But elsewhere, I do see the name Brendan Rodgers being floated about as a replacement. Would that be a suitable appointment? Would Manchester United fans take to the appointment of Brendan Rodgers?
I think that would be more divisive, not a potential replacement. But it's quite weird. I think Solskjaer is such a figure among United fans, and this has actually been a feature up until recently, where before fans turned against him, or not turned against him, that's the wrong word to use, before fans basically kind of realised this isn't it, where so many potential alternatives were kind of almost dismissed with United. There was almost this angry debate about it all. But Roger still feels like, and not because of the Liverpool history, maybe it's because of Roger's recent career, and even the way he speaks a little bit, wouldn't feel very United. Now, the word had gone round that he spoke to United last week. As of last night, you know, people on both sides were kind of denying that. But there's absolutely no doubt that United, if it came to replacing Solskjaer, which, you know, many would say it should be, he'd be one of the names they'd look at, along with Pochettino, along with Ten Hag. the problem at right now being all those are in jobs, and I think at kind of top clubs these days, it is harder to extract people from jobs in that way. I mean, I've seen the argument made, in fact, I've talked to a few people in the last few days about how United should basically do what they do with players and just go and pay what it takes to extract Ten Hag from Ajax. But from what I've heard, he just wouldn't consider it whatsoever. He just out of his love for Ajax and out of the situation he's in and the way he wants to work, he would want to give himself a full season at any club and wouldn't want to leave anyone in the lurch. And it means that United are kind of in this strange situation now where I think, you know, there is a realisation this is probably done. Like I think Barney Rene referred to it on Saturday as zombie football, and that's kind of it, because there's almost this feeling around the club that they're just hoping that Solskjaer steadies things enough that they can get to the end of the season respectably, get top four, maybe even a Champions League one. I mean, this is one of the odd things about...
They could win the Champions League. They could absolutely win the Champions League.
That is a potential direction.
I mean, I think they'd have a better chance of winning it with another coach, but they could. It's possible they could win the Champions League. Yeah,
yeah. It's happened before in football history. Many times. Like, that's the nature of a cup competition, especially cup competition, just features kind of like this group of super clubs kind of just crashing against each other. It can happen, and you know, I suppose that's the ultimate hope for some of the club, but right now, so there are no viable medium-term appointments. There are no viable interims. Although Solskjaer himself was, he was out of left field really in December 2018, and that initially worked out well. Whatever you think about what happened after they appointed him, there are maybe potential options there. But for now, it still feels like we're in a situation where this is going to go on until something so drastic happens, and they really, because they're still actually not that far off top four either, which is remarkable in all this. So there is that hope that he steadies things, and it would really take a real drop off thing to actually make a move. But let's see, it is international week, and given everything else that's happened in the Premier League over the past few days, that sometimes has that kind of contagion effect. But right now, he's preparing to be in charge for Watford.
Okay, that's Miguel Delaney speaking to us, sitting on his new flat pack chair, enjoying the fruits of his labour, his Sunday labour. Thanks, Miguel. Thanks, Jacob.
Cheers, lads.
It happened to me on the darts.
It's time to get busy in this motherfucker.
Like we always do about this time.
Okay, I'm going to reveal a piece of information now. Well, I haven't smoked a cigarette in 4 days.
So what I'm saying is to this guy, cheer up. How about you wake up?
Last time I took the dart, I was over to split.
Wake up. Wake up to what's happening in the world.
Hey, Pat, do you want a split? You know?
Pencil. We talked about Roy Keane. We talked about David Moyes. We talked about Roy Keane. Ken, you're throwing Roy Keane's name into the hat for the United job. What about Brendan Rodgers? We just touched on him there. I mean, Miguel thinks his media persona mightn't be that of a Manchester United manager. I'm not sure. There's obviously the Liverpool background. There's the fact that Leicester are struggling a little bit this season. That mightn't go down too well. But what do you think? Could Rodgers be a win for Man United?
Oh, I would approach with caution.
Why?
Well, I just feel as though, like, I just don't think that he would actually excite United fans that much. You know, I think that he would be an improvement on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as a coach. I do think that he has achieved more as a coach and has produced some teams, has managed some teams that have played a lot better football than Solskjaer has, most recently in the Leicester 4-2. But, you know, he's managing Leicester. They're 12th in the league. Like, to get rid of Solskjaer to appoint the former Liverpool manager, who's the Leicester manager, and they're 12th, who bottled the Champions League. You know, bottled is the word that people use in football when you miss out at the very end. You know, I know he's maintained a top four position if you look at the average points, or, you know, he's been in the top four for like 30 or 72 out of the last 76 weeks or whatever. But they ended up not in there. And you're talking about bringing him in. I just feel as though United fans might think we were sort of hoping that when this change did come, if it had to come, that it would be a clear improvement. And maybe it is an improvement, but just not enough of an improvement. And we're going to bring in Rodgers, and, you know, he's kind of been a bit of a nearly man. He was at Liverpool. Talks a bit of nonsense sometimes. You know, he's got that sort of... So he talks a little bit of nonsense. And I just feel as though, yeah. But, like, you know, again, I don't want to put the hex on this thing. Again, I would tune in to watch.
Republic of Ireland.
Manchester United user here, Owen, and I would.
I am a
be
user.
Very
I'm a heavy. I'm a heavy user of Manchester United.
I would not
United.
Be particularly excited.
I should. I need to cut down. Brent I need Rogers. To cut down on my Manchester United consumption, for God's sake. But like for now, I am a user, and if Rodgers was manager, I couldn't see that changing.
We'll be all tuning in to watch Republic of Ireland against Portugal on Thursday night. Hopefully, Bruno Fernandes and Cristiano Ronaldo have been rattled by recent events at Manchester United, and we'll be issuing apologies to their Portuguese supporters come Friday morning. We'll have coverage through the week of that game. Also, a big match coming up for the Irish rugby team with New Zealand on Saturday. So it is an exciting week ahead for World Service members only. Well, you might have an exciting week in your own life if you're a non-member, but what I'm saying is World Service members will be treated to exciting shows every day this week. You can sign up now on secondcaptains.com. Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen, and thank you, Ciarán.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Ken.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's to persuade the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.